content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We'll be resuming the fall 2019 issue, She Changed the World, North Carolina Women Making History. That's volume 59, number 1 of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. The next article we'll be reading is Edith Vanderbilt, Women Have Come Into Their Own by Morgan Johnson. Morgan Johnson is a senior history major at Meredith College, minoring in public history and Spanish. It was 1921, and a large crowd had gathered in the General Assembly Gallery in Raleigh to hear one of the first women in history formally address the state legislature. Who was she? Edith Vanderbilt, a philanthropist and a socialite from Rhode Island. She was the newly elected first woman president of the North Carolina State Fair. Vanderbilt arrived in North Carolina in 1898. She had just married one of the most eligible bachelors in the world, George Vanderbilt. His family was very prominent in the railroad business, and as a result, Vanderbilt had inherited an extreme amount of wealth. He had a deep appreciation for art and decided to spend his fortune building a large, ornate estate in Asheville, the Biltmore Estate. This was the Vanderbilts' home after their honeymoon. The house and gardens were beautiful, and it would have been easy to simply enjoy the scenery. But Edith Vanderbilt decided to dedicate her time toward making a difference. Like most wealthy women of the era, she did not have a job outside the home and spent her time and money doing charity work. She had a close relationship with the workers on the estate, buying Christmas presents for them every year, hand-delivering supplies to new mothers, and arranging school transportation for the children. Outside of her work on the estate, Vanderbilt helped establish Biltmore Estate Industries, BEI, helped young mountaineers make money by educating them in the art of handicrafts. They learned how to make things like wood carvings and homespun wool. In 1901, Vanderbilt also founded the Biltmore School of Domestic Science to train young black women for jobs in domestic service. She also started the Moonlight School at Biltmore Estate to teach estate workers how to read and write. Edith's experience helping rural and agricultural North Carolina made her a great candidate for president of the state fair. Around the time she was elected, the other fair leaders wanted to make the event more appealing to families and children. Vanderbilt's experience helping farming families in the Biltmore community made her a perfect fit, and she led the fair from 1921 to 1924. Unsurprisingly, not everyone was thrilled about having the first woman president of the state fair. Critics said Vanderbilt would not be invested in the job and that other leaders of the fair would have to pick up the slack. Resistance also came when it was time for Vanderbilt to deliver her speech to the General Assembly. Many North Carolinians thought it was inappropriate for a woman to be involved in politics and government. However, since it was traditional for new state fair presidents to address the General Assembly, in the end, Vanderbilt was able to make her full speech. In it, she acknowledged the significance of her position as the first woman to head the fair and address the General Assembly. As president, Vanderbilt proposed a system designed to increase involvement from younger North Carolinians. This plan would create connections between boys and girls clubs to county fairs and the county fairs to the state fair. She asked the General Assembly for more funds, which would contribute to improved buildings and exhibits. She also created special competition categories for school-aged children, and she personally awarded the prizes. These competitions included drawing, clay sculpture, short stories, and history essays. Vanderbilt was clearly dedicated to making the fair more accessible to rural North Carolina, and especially to children from those areas. Edith Vanderbilt was able to use her experience with charity work to make her mark on North Carolina history. In spite of the limits that society placed upon women as to what jobs and leadership positions they could hold. She cared deeply about the farming families in the Biltmore community, especially the children, and used these values to inspire her work with the fair. Although some doubted her ability to be a good leader, as president, Vanderbilt voiced her opinions and took action to improve the fair. Her experience is just a glimpse into what women can achieve when given the opportunity to pursue their passions. Here are some of the photographs that are accompanying this article along with their captions. This clipping from the News and Observer of Raleigh documents Edith Vanderbilt's appearance before the North Carolina State Legislature as the first woman president of the state fair. The headline declares that she completely captivates state legislators. The headline below said, delivers brief address at joint session of House and Senate. The price of the News and Observer was 5 cents. It also says that she attends meeting of Executive Committee of North Carolina Agricultural Society after address and is formally inducted into office as president of the 1921 State Fair. A photograph of Biltmore Estate, which was built in 1889 to 1895, as photographed in 1902. Also, Edith Vanderbilt and Cornelia at the dedication ceremony for the Pisgah National Forest. There's a quote from her speech to the General Assembly. This is a day when women have come into their own. Gentlemen, I at once assume a responsibility in thanking you in the name of my fellow sisters for what you have done, for in conferring this distinction upon me, you have included them. And that has a photograph with it of Edith Vanderbilt and her daughter Cornelia at the North Carolina State Fair. Another photograph of Edith Vanderbilt with her young daughter Cornelia from 1906. And the last photograph, in March 1907, the New York Times featured a front page story on Vanderbilt wearing a gown made of homespun cloth woven by artisans who worked for Biltmore Industries, a business the Vanderbilts developed to provide economic support for local crafters in the community. In this circa 1924 photo, the ever-stylish Edith wears a suit of homespun cloth. The next article is Quilt Speak, Uncovering Women's Voices Through Quilts. It's written by Diana Bell Kite, who is curator of cultural history at the North Carolina Museum of History. She was also the curator of the museum's exhibit, Quilt Speak, Uncovering Women's Voices Through Quilts, from 2019, and its accompanying catalog. Do you have any homemade quilts in your home? Have you seen one at your grandparents' house or at a museum? Maybe they just seem like nice blankets to you. But did you know that quilts can speak? Quilts speak. They reveal voices from the past, specifically women's voices. Some of these voices have long been silenced by illiteracy, racial oppression, gender inequity, and exhaustion. But if we know how to listen, we can understand what the quilts are saying. They speak of skill and power. They speak of economy and ingenuity. They speak of memory and forgetting. They reveal the experiences of women whose lives skirted the edges of written history. What can quilts tell us about their makers? What can they tell us about the history of women in North Carolina? What can they tell us about ourselves? I control, speaking of skill and power. For upper-class white women of the slaveholding South, quilts meant more than warmth. They communicated status and power. These makers had money for needlework education and pricey imported fabrics. They could spend time stitching showpieces rather than farming or doing housework. Those with little power made quilts too. Enslaved women quilted, whether for their enslavers or for their own families. Quilting as a social marker declined after the Civil War, the end of slavery and the rise of industrialization, including North Carolina's textile mills, transformed society. Now, women of all backgrounds began to practice the formerly elite craft. I provide, speaking of economy and ingenuity. By the late 1800s, the southern textile industry was growing. Women of all backgrounds could now find affordable fabric for quilting. They used the bed covers they made to provide their families with warmth. Women also used other products, feed sacks, tobacco giveaways, and factory seconds in their creations. Their reuse of such consumer products influenced manufacturers' marketing and production. Racial tensions grew during this period, and some of the quilts that women made speak to the complicated and unequal relationships of the Jim Crow era. I remember, speaking of memory and forgetting. Some quilts hold meaning beyond the need to keep warm or display status. They teach us what their makers wanted remembered. Memory quilters frequently use their bed covers to mark life's milestones. For other makers, their bed covers' meanings changed over time. New generations attached significance to quilts never intended to be memory objects. Still, other quilters sought to tell personal and community stories through their creations, often interpreting the past in selective and intriguing ways. Who makes history? Voices can be heard in many ways if you know how to listen. In the past, we have prioritized voices expressed through the written word, voices of those who were literate and free, and often white, male, and financially comfortable. The voices we heard shaped our notions of the past and our beliefs about who made history. In recent decades, historians have begun to look for new ways to listen. As a result, new voices have emerged, complicating and enriching our understanding of the past. Who makes history? Is it just famous people? Or do the ordinary people also have a voice in the story? And what can we do as historians to find and listen to voices that are not always heard? Whose voices will endure to inform forthcoming generations' impressions of our times? How will your voice be heard? There are a couple of photographs accompanying this article. A young visitor practices quilt making techniques at a quilt event at the North Carolina Museum of History in 2019. And another with a quote, "In the past, quilting bees, like this gathering in Northampton County, brought women together to socialize as they shared in the work of hand stitching a beautiful but useful quilt." The photograph is called Northampton County Quilters, 1939, from the Charles Anderson Farrell Photographic Collection of the North Carolina Collection Photographic Archives at the Wilson Library at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This article also has several quilts photographed and has some accompanying information. One is called the Eight-Pointed Star, which was made from 1963 to 1967. "I reckon it was born in me to love to quilt," said Lee Jacobs, late in life, 1909 to 2000. Raised in the Waccamaw Siouan community of Buckhead in Columbus County, Jacobs learned to quilt from her grandmother, who would give her tiny bits of fabric to play with. Lee sewed throughout her life. She made quilts to give to family and friends and to support tribal charities. She stitched this bed cover as a wedding gift for her daughter, Vonnie. There's another, letter H, from 1955. As a teenager, Edith Smith, born in 1903, died in 1983, became a domestic service in Roland and Lenore Williams' household, and she assumed an especially important role in their two children's lives after Lenore died young. Edith married in 1939 and later adopted her niece Clyde, whom she raised and sent to college at Shaw University. Smith eventually adopted her great-niece and great-nephew after their mother's sudden death. Smith made this quilt as a wedding gift for one of the white children she helped raise. Did the letter H hold meaning for her or the recipient? And why did she include one peculiar lone O? There's also a painting of Edith Faison Smith from circa 1920, a painting by Mary Lyde Hicks Williams. Williams's family owned the plantation where Edith Smith grew up. And the third quilt is Lone Star, 1902 to 1903. For her 1902 quilt project, Wake County's 16-year-old Eula Mae Bagwell, born 1886, died 1969, chose a pattern, Lone Star, that had been popular for a century. But the fabrics were very modern for the times. A farm woman would not have been able to afford these rich indigo prints a generation earlier. But the development of inexpensive synthetic indigo dye in the mid-1800s made the blue fabrics widely available by the turn of the century. The next article is Polly Murray, The Imp Crusader by Sally Bloom. Sally Bloom wants everyone to know that they actually do love history. Whatever your passion, it has history. Sally also writes and produces educational and entertaining videos about our pasts and organizes the Longleaf Film Festival. She teaches via live streaming events and runs professional development workshops for educators at the North Carolina Museum of History. Writer, attorney, priest, civil rights activist, feminist, professor. For most people, achieving any one of these is a major accomplishment. For one person to have done them all speaks to a life of dedication and hard work. For Polly Murray, who was all of these things, the story also includes courage and perseverance as she overcame hurdles of segregation, racism, and sexism in her life's work of advocacy. Anna Pauline Polly Murray was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1910. Following her mother's death, she grew up in Durham, North Carolina, with her Aunt Pauline and her grandparents, Robert and Cornelia Fitzgerald. The Fitzgeralds insisted on a sound education for Murray. Her grandfather had been a teacher, and so was her Aunt Pauline, who taught for some 60 years in the Durham public schools. After high school, Polly attended Hunter College in New York. She graduated in 1933. Murray then applied to attend graduate school at the University of North Carolina, but she was denied entrance, not because of her grades, but because of her race. Instead, she attended law school at Howard University, a historically black college and university, HBCU, and graduated at the top of her class, and the only woman, in 1944. Usually Howard's top graduate was awarded a fellowship to Harvard, but Murray was denied this opportunity because of her sex. Persevering, Murray continued her studies, and in 1965 she was the first African American to receive a Doctor of Juridical Science from Yale University. Murray had faced discrimination because of her race and sex, so she devoted herself to working for civil rights for all. Foreshadowing activists of the 1960s civil rights movement, in 1940, Murray was arrested for protesting against a Virginia law requiring segregation on buses. In 1941, she helped form the Congress of Racial Equality, C-O-R-E, or CORE. As a student at Howard Law School, Murray participated in restaurant sit-ins. In 1951, she wrote the book States Laws on Race and Color. Thurgood Marshall of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, called her book The Bible for Civil Rights Lawyers. Murray's 1956 memoirs, Proud Shoes, The Story of an American Family, describes growing up in her grandparents' home in Durham. Her grandfather, Robert G. Fitzgerald, was the son of a free man of color, and his wife, who was white. Fitzgerald was a Union veteran and an educator. Murray's grandmother, Cornelia Smith, was the daughter of prominent white Chapel Hill lawyer Sidney Smith and an enslaved woman, Harriet Day, who was owned by Smith. At the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Murray wrote Jane Crow and the Law, Sex Discrimination in Title VII, which depicted the strong analogy between Jim Crow laws and sex-based discrimination. At a conference, she met feminist author Betty Friedan, author of The Feminine Mystique. Together with other like-minded women, they formed the National Organization of Women, NOW, Now, which advocates for civil rights for women. At 62, Murray entered the General Theological Seminary at a time when the Episcopal Church did not allow women to become priests. After completing her Master of Divinity in 1976, Murray became the first American woman priest ordained by the Episcopal Church. She celebrated her first Eucharist at the Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in 1977. This service allowed all the strands of Murray's life to come together, for it was here that her enslaved grandmother, Cornelia Smith, had been baptized in 1854. After retiring from the Episcopal Church, Murray continued to work as a typewriter advocate. She died in 1985. Her poem titled Prophecy aptly speaks to Murray's vision of equality for everyone. I sing of a new American, separate from all others, yet enlarged and diminished by all others. I am the child of kings and serfs, freemen and slaves, having neither superiors nor inferiors, progeny of all colors, all cultures, all systems, all beliefs. I have been enslaved, yet my spirit is unbound. I have been cast aside, but I sparkle in the darkness. I have been slain, but live on in the rivers of history. I seek no conquest, no wealth, no power, no revenge. I seek only discovery of the illimitable heights and depths of my own being. There are a couple of photographs which accompany the article. Here are their captions. There were many sides to activist Pauli Murray. She labeled this photo, taken when she was about 21, the Imp, 1931. It definitely captures the humor, intelligence, and mischievous energy that must have helped fuel her activism. Later in life, Murray continued to work for social justice after becoming the first African-American female priest ordained by the Episcopal Church. In 1977, she held her first Eucharist at the Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, where her enslaved great-grandmother had been baptized in 1854. There's also a sidebar article, The Pauli Murray Family Home in Durham. In her 1956 memoir, Proud Shoes, Pauli Murray wrote about her maternal grandparents, Cornelia and Robert Fitzgerald, who raised their family in Durham. It was to this home that Murray moved as a young child after the death of her mother. Built in 1898 at 906 Carroll Street, the house is today referred to as the Pauli Murray Family Home. In 2015, the home was named as a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and in 2017 was designated a national landmark by the National Park Service. The Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice has worked to restore the home and has plans to open it as a museum in 2020. To learn more, go to Pauli Murray Project, that's PauliMurray Project.org. It has a couple of photographs, a young Pauli Murray in one of them, and the other, the Pauli Murray Family Home in Durham. Next, a closer look at women who changed the world. Westre Battle Boyce, born in 1901, died in 1972. Westre Battle Boyce, a Rocky Mount native, enlisted in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, the WACs, or WAACs, in 1942 during World War II. WAC trained its members to perform non-combat tasks, freeing up male soldiers to enter combat. With her intelligence and skills, Boyce quickly moved up the ranks and earned recognition and respect from her male superiors. In 1943, she was transferred to North Africa, promoted to lieutenant colonel, and attached to the staff of General Dwight D. Eisenhower. During her assignment, the WAC became the Women's Army Corps, went from WAAC to WAC, and gained for its members full military status and benefits. Selma Burke, born 1900, died 1995. In 1943, Selma Burke entered a competition to create a profile portrait of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and won. Her sculpture also served as the model for the reimagined 10-cent coin and has appeared on the dime ever since. Burke is the most prominent sculptor from North Carolina to have been awarded a presidential artistic commission. Her success as a sculptor proved singular and remarkable at a time when female African-American artists were rarely recognized. Ella Mae Wiggins, born around 1900, died around 1929. After her husband abandoned their family, Ella Mae Wiggins went to work in a spinning room at the American Mill, a textile mill, to support herself and her children. To protest the harsh conditions in the mill, she joined the National Textile Workers Union when labor union organizers came to Gaston County. Because of her talents as a writer and speaker, she was chosen as secretary of the local union and often spoke on their behalf. Her passionate speeches described the difficult working conditions, long hours, and low pay in the textile mills. She often sang the song Mill Workers Lament about the harshness of mill work. We leave our home in the morning, we kiss our children goodbye, while we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocer's bill to pay, not a cent to keep for clothing, not a cent to lay away. In 1929, as Ella Mae Wiggins was riding in a truck with other union organizers, armed men fired on the group. Wiggins was killed. Many textile workers believe her death was planned. Priscilla Freeman Jacobs, born in 1940. Priscilla Freeman Jacobs led the Waccamaw-Suan, one of North Carolina's eight state-recognized American Indian tribes, from 1986 through early 2005. She followed in the footsteps of her grandfather, great-uncle, and father when she became chief. During her time in command, she represented her tribe at many civic affairs and educational programs, sharing the traditions and cultures of her people. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, northcarolinareadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.